Welcome everyone to Imperfect Leaders. In today's episode, we are so fortunate to have Professor Dave Ulrich, an incredible thought leader at the University of Michigan, who has spent most of his life educating and inspiring leaders around the world. In his view, and mine too, transcendent leaders must be able to create a culture that shines a positive light on their teammates and inspires others to reach their full potential. The good professor explains how business leaders and superstar athletes like NBA world champ Nikola Jokic of the Denver Nuggets are hardcore culture builders and team players every bit as much as they are individual stars. So sit back and enjoy today's conversation with my new friend, Professor Dave Ulrich.
So very simple in your head, competence, the ability, commitment, willing to work hard, contribution, finding purpose in the hard work we do.
So I can imagine that the competence piece would be easy for an organization to assess ahead of time, but the commitment and the contribution, how can I, if I see this external superstar that I'm just salivating, I want that person in my organization. And I see, again, I see sports teams, you know, look at a professional basketball player that they really want to come on their team because that player is so good. But they get to the team and they destroy chemistry and they're not committed. Like, how can you tell that?
Well, they're committed, but you just captured one of the fascinating issues. Talent matters. Teamwork matters more. We've done a lot of research on this. What matters more, the great individual skill, talent, competence, commitment, I'm committed, or the team that plays well together? And in the research we've got, team outperforms individual at delivering results 2 to 3 to 1. Wow. And sports is the great case. I'll give an old case and I'll give a new case.
Okay.
Michael Jordan, self-defined, self-declared, best basketball, and literally the best basketball player in probably NBA, one of the best in history. He's on the Mount Rushmore. He won 9 scoring titles. 9 titles, and he left for a year or two. He probably would have won more. Three times, he did not win the championship, and he scored 36 points a game. 6 times, he won the championship. What happened to his scoring average?
Went down
to 30. Until his personal average dropped 20%, the team didn't win. Talent matters. Teamwork matters even more.
So how does a leader of the Chicago Bulls get somebody as great as Michael Jordan to stop shooting so much?
What's the question you'd ask Jordan? Michael Jordan, you're the best player in the league. You got the MVP every year you want it. Do you want the championship? Yes. And he would say, of course, I deserve it. You got to drop your scoring average. You got to make leadership. I mean, it's leadership. That's our topic, Jeff. Leader's job is to make people around him better. Mm-hmm. Leader's job is not to lead and be in charge. Leader's job is to build others and make them better. Michael Jordan, do you want to win a championship or a scoring title? And he says both, and say, if you had to pick. And you see it today. And I like sports. There are great cases of this. Kevin Durant, not Kyrie Irving, they go to the New Jersey Nets. Great talent, and the chemistry's not there. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work for whatever reason. I don't know. You know, there's probably 100 reasons. Phoenix just pulls in Kevin Durant. Their challenge right now I'm doing this, make it more timely. Can they put a team around him that makes the whole more than the parts? And if they will, they've got a chance of winning. If he wins the scoring title this year, the odds are they're not going to win the championship.
Hmm. So why did a smart guy like Mark Cuban decide that he wanted to bring in Kyrie Irving when he didn't do well at the Nets, like you just said?
You know, it would be fun to go on Shark Tank and ask him and to say, you know, you're a smart guy. Would you like to learn something? And his view is that, in theory, Kyrie Irving and the other guy who's so good, that 1 + 1 is going to equal 3. Hmm. And if it does, it's going to work. Last year, in only a quarter of the season, it didn't work. They lost more games with Irving than without him. So that's the magic of leaders. Leaders' job is to take good individuals and make the team great. And that's an art and a science. That's not easy to do.
And so I don't know if you like the Denver Nuggets or not, but I do.
They're a great example.
And I'm a season ticket holder. And, you know, I go to half the season Why are they so good? I mean, talk about leadership and culture in an organization like the Denver Nuggets. And I don't want to put you on the spot because I don't know.
Well, I'm happy to put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you, you're the expert. What makes Jokic so good?
Well, it's certainly not because he can jump high, and it's certainly not because he's fast, but he's so damn good. He's a generational talent. Like, he has such a great court awareness. He hits the open man. He would rather pass to somebody than shoot, even though he can pretty much score anytime he wants. And when they asked him that, why do you pass so much? It's because he said, I can make two people happy. I get the assist and they get the score.
You've just named four things. He's got court awareness. Now apply this to a company. You have situational awareness. He passes. He makes others better. The job of a leader is not to do the job. We are new people to leaders say, oh, I want to be a great leader. We say there's four stages. Stage one, can you do the work? Okay, I can do the work. That's important. You got to be able to do the work. I mean, Jokic, when he shoots, he's got to be able to hit it. Stage two, can you make a team better? Can you share this stuff? And in a company, stage three, does the work get done when you're not present? Stage two to three, in three stages, stage two to three is when you've built a system, call it a culture, call it a system. In football, that's the process at Alabama. It's not just tied to Lou Saban. It's there's a system. And if you love basketball, that's John Wooden. I went to UCLA. I mean, John Wooden built a system.
Totally.
And that system is what leaders. So let me go back to it. If I'm a leader, number one, you got to be able to do the work. Leaders who don't have basic skills are going to get found out pretty quickly. You got to be able to work with the team. You got to make others better. You see them, you work with them, you nurture them, Jokic at Denver. And then three, you want to create a system ultimately has more impact on long-term outcomes than the individual.
I feel like we all get so enamored at that external super in sports. It's, you know, the external superstar like Kyrie. In business, it's that charismatic corporate savior from the outside, even though, you know, he or she may not fit into the system.
Absolutely. And then what you look for, we went back when you bring a leader in, you want to bring in a leader who says, my job is not just to be in front. It's to get the people and the other people moving fast. Let me give where sometimes it's fun to know, where do you learn this stuff? And there's research and books and people write Harvard cases 25 years ago that were brilliantly done. I learned it doing bike riding with a bunch of young men. Huh. So I've got a bunch of kids, 13 to 17. We're going on an 8-day bike ride, 50, 60 miles a day. And I'm teaching them how to ride bikes and to get all together and to ride and to draft. And I say, okay, I'm going to be the leader and I'm going to get us going from, and again, I have very modest goals if you bike ride. I want to get us from going 12 miles an hour to 14. So I start and I'm in front and I'm big and I draft and I'm 14 and I go for 20 minutes and I look behind me and there's 100 yards behind me. They just went, you know, the old fat guy's going 14 miles an hour. We're going to go 12. Didn't work. So I thought, what have I got to do to get these guys to move? And so I go to a young guy and I say, you're in charge. We're going to ride for an hour, 45 minutes. You're in charge. And he starts off at 12 miles an hour. And I, and again, have the visual, two wheels on a bike. I'm at his back wheel. And I'm saying, you are doing such a good job. You are doing such a good job. And right behind his back wheel, we start at 12, 12 and a half, 13. Within 10 minutes, I got every kid up to 14. Because they were in front and I was leading from the side or from behind. And I think sometimes that's the greatest leadership. And somebody had a line, it's not the sage on the stage. It's the guy by your side. It's a silly line. But in that bike riding, if you can see it. Now, again, this is not a Peloton. This is not somebody who's going to go win. People would laugh at us because we're not that good at bike riders. But I thought, you know, that's an interesting lesson on leadership. You don't have to be in front. In fact, you're almost better off getting somebody else to be in front. Because then when you back away, they own the accountability.
This all reminds me of culture. And I can't remember who said it, but what does it mean when people say that culture eats strategy for breakfast?
Culture is the pattern. And there's three ways that we've looked at culture. It's the values. It's the values that are embedded in a company. So we do a little value statement. It's the way we go about making decisions, treating people. A second way, it's our systems. A third way, it's the unwritten rules. When you're in a nice restaurant, there's an unwritten rule of how you dress, of how you deal with a waiter or waitress. If you're in a not nice restaurant, there's unwritten rules. We have now moved, and those are the three kind of ways people have looked at culture: your values, your systems, your unwritten rules. We now look at culture in a different way, and I'm so glad you asked. Let me give the headline and then the story. Culture is the identity of your firm in the mind of your best customer. That's the headline. Now let me go back. When I want to create a culture in my company, I don't start with my values. I don't start with my systems or the patterns. I start by saying, it's brand. What do we want to be known for by our best customer that's going to cause them to choose us? You worked at Harvard Business School. Harvard wants to be known as a thought leader. They want to be known as somebody who's brilliant. You worked at CEO leadership, and you worked with brilliant people. They want to be known as providing knowledge and insights that's fresh. If that's the external identity that gets people to subscribe to HBR or to join CEO leadership, that external identity brand should be reflected in the internal practices and systems. It should be reflected in the values. So one of the things I love to do with companies, you have a value statement. I asked this last week with this group in India. What's on your value statement? We value innovation. We value collaboration. We value integrity. Super. Take them to your customers. Ask them three questions. Are these the values you want us to have? 90%, who doesn't agree with integrity and innovation? Sometimes it filters it out. I was in a company, I did that a number of years ago. Their number one value, we want to be the most profitable firm in our industry. And I said, think about that if I'm a customer. Your goal is to be the most profitable. That means you're going to screw me over every time you can. We're not going to define the behavior. You are. What does innovation mean to you? What does service mean to you? What does collaboration mean to you? And if they're these abstract aspirations, they don't have any meaning. But when they get very concrete, when you see this, you have defined us as an innovative company. Question three. Question one, are these the values you want us to have? Question two, you tell us the behaviors we need to demonstrate to you. Question three, when we do that, will you buy more? And that third, I was doing this talk in front of a group of 1,500 business leaders, and I could see them going, oh, here comes the culture guy. You know, we're going to feel good. We're going to have a bring the pet to work. And I said, that's not culture. It's three questions. Are these the values you want us to have? What are the behaviors? Will you buy more? And they said, say that third one again. If your culture doesn't cause customers to buy more from you, you don't have a good culture.
Or how often do you see the behaviors conflict with what they say their values are or what the customer thinks?
Too often. Why? And they conflict because we're not rigorous about it. Amazon got criticized in different places for being so demanding and rigorous on their people. And then I say, I don't know, Jeff, do you buy from Amazon? We do. We buy a lot from Amazon.
I don't know anyone who doesn't, really.
They all do. Why? Why do I pick Amazon? And you could buy today from any company. Almost anybody's got an e-distribution system. What kind of internal company do they have to be predictable, easy, and reliable?
They have to
loose
be
loose or tight.
Tight. They have to be obsessively tight.
You got it. Amazon has built and they're not the same in Amazon Web Services. So in Amazon Online, they were a tight culture. Now, if they're abusive to people, that's different. I mean, nobody agrees with any, you know, if somebody's abusing somebody emotionally or physically, that's bad. But people say, Amazon's really tight. They're very demanding. And I'm going, that's why I'm buying from them. I talked to someone today in France. He said, I ordered this book Saturday and it showed up Monday. You got to be kidding me. Well, that requires some incredible discipline inside. And they've built a culture inside that matches their customer expectations outside.
And so the tighter and more rigid their behaviors are internally, the more likely the customer is to buy from them.
That's it. They've got some incredible systems to be tight. They've actually got, because we've done work with, and it's public stuff, they watch your eyeballs. And if you linger longer on an item, you're very likely at a certain, and they know your history. I've bought novels by certain authors. If there's a new book come out and my eyeball lingers more than so many seconds on that book, they know I'm going to buy it, and it's already ready to be delivered before I hit buy.
That's amazing.
I just amazing, amazing.
And so when they're recruiting somebody, they're looking for somebody that really fits into the mold, the Amazon mold, and will have that kind of behaviors. Is that kind of homogeneity crushing diversity and potentially innovation because they're doing the same thing or not?
Well, where should they innovate? They should innovate where customers need innovation. You don't want to hire people who act and look like everybody else because you're not going to get innovation. The value of diversity is getting people who do differently. But Amazon should constantly be saying, what does that next generation customer care about? And one of the things they may be beginning to identify is, if there are people listening to this, the young leaders under 25, I care about social citizenship. I care about social responsibility. So I was thinking about this yesterday as I was unboxing my Amazon boxes. I wonder if somebody at Amazon is paying attention to cardboard.
Yes. It's a
And
great question, and it's such a huge problem.
it's a huge cost. I mean, I put three boxes in our garbage can last night, and I thought, I wonder if anyone at Amazon, because they must be the one of the biggest cardboard users in the world. Are they finding ways? And if I'm under 25, I'm a customer saying, boy, I could buy those books from three different vendors. If Amazon is telling me they're more socially responsible, carbon footprint, whatever it is, I may lean to them a little more. So somebody needs to be driving that innovation that gets us to the next step, navigating that paradox. What got us here, keep doing. What's going to get us there, invent. And so how do you navigate the paradox of the past and the present?
So we talked about being an ambivert, earlier. What about being ambidextrous? So how does a company create a culture that, you do one thing very efficiently and the other thing you're actually doing non-efficiently? It's not efficient at all. In fact, you're trying to innovate.
In fact, in our research, when we looked at leadership skills, so in those five buckets, what are the skills leaders need to have? One of the biggest predictors of leadership success is the ability to navigate, not manage, navigate paradox, ambidextrous, yin yang, duality, whatever you want to call it. Can I live in a world that requires both social citizenship and economic accountability? And what I love to see, and again, this is a temptation we fall prey to. I'm guilty of it. We love to show a slide that says from day to day to long term, from short term to long term, from centralized to decentralized. Every time now I see that slide, I say, nope, that's wrong. It's and also.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it either or is
No,
it
it's all
and?
and also. And
We had a
that's
guest
the
on the
net.
show, Roger Martin, who I love. I love this guy. And he was much more of a, like an integrative thinker. It's and, not either or.
Absolutely. That's paradox. And Roger Martin is brilliant. I mean, he's on that Thinkers 50 list at the very top and deserves it. But I love the, and most people say, well, put a verb before paradox. Well, you manage paradox. You don't manage paradox. You navigate it. You live in a constant world of uncertainty, which is where the diversity comes in. If I have a team of a bunch of strategists, go back to where we started, I don't need another strategist. I need an executor, a talent manager. I need somebody who brings in the tension that will allow us to get creativity. And we have found that navigating paradox by respecting differences and exploring them becomes a key leadership skill.
But like you say, when you bring in more diversity, you're going to have a more coarse discussion, and that could cause conflict. So that sort of brings us full circle to the leadership. What does the leader need to do to make sure the diverse people aren't just butting heads, but actually coming up with more innovation and aligning as a team?
I'm laughing. I've written quite a few books, and I decided during COVID to not write a book when everybody else was. I want to be counter. So I started posting, and I happened to choose LinkedIn. You could use any number of places to post. And I am posting tomorrow. Now that's going to be way after this. What are 10 skills of managing conflict? Because I think we live in a world of conflict. How do you begin to be a peacemaker? How do you begin to learn to listen to the other people? How do you disagree without being disagreeable? How do you state a position without demeaning somebody else's position? How do you try to find common ground? We've identified 10 specific skills that a leader can manage in navigating paradox, which is inherently conflict, And we think that's so necessary today. There's global conflict. We won't. You and I aren't going to solve global wars, country boundaries, millennia of history behind them. We aren't even going to solve political problems where parties can't get together and work together. But maybe in our daily lives, we can, and the word that gets used by others, Arthur Brooks and other people smarter, love your enemies, pay attention to them, care for them, and don't have to agree with them, but learn to be able to disagree in a good way.
And we're not good at that yet. So from your experience, are these skills that most leaders have in helping people manage the conflict, or is this something where they can definitely improve?
Great question. Don't know for sure. I study conflict. I still get sucked in to defending my position rather than trying to find common ground.
Why?
I mean, because I'm a geek and a nerd, and somebody on LinkedIn attacks my work and they say something that's kind of, you know, Dave Ulrich believes this. And I feel like saying, hi, I'm Dave Ulrich. That's not what I believe. And instead of saying, oh, thank you for trying to figure that out, let me ask you a question. Let me try to explore. And I get caught in that trap of defending, not trying to learn.
And you think that's common, though? That's my point.
I think it's very common. And I think our world reinforces it. Look at the TV shows, Survivor, Apprentice. There's one winner and 12 losers. Well, that's a horrible metaphor. And it's a paradox, because winning doesn't mean you give up. It means you use the gifts and skills that you've got to help others build their gifts. Guess what? Every relationship has conflicts.
Absolutely.
And the research says 50 to 60% are never solved. You learn to live with them. I've been in a relationship for almost 40, I don't, I should know this, over 45 years. We still have differences. I tend to be on time. My wife tends to not be on time. I tend to leave cupboards open. She tends to close cupboards. I'm messy. She's clean. Why is that person behaving that way? Ask five whys. Figure out what in their past, and maybe they had a different parenting experience than you did. Maybe they had a different boss than you did. Understand. And once that understanding's there, the empathy, the emotion, the caring, the compassion, whichever word you want, begins to allow you to care for somebody in a positive way.
And Dave, these are such meaty topics. You know, we talk about leadership and culture and really humanity, you know, all the things we're talking about. Just personally, how did you become interested in these topics?
My leaders were my mother and my father, my aunts, my uncles, the people that taught me. I, in fact, one of the things, and people aren't seeing this video, there's my children, I may have it. My children made a book for me. This is your great grandpa Ulrich to give to our grandchildren.
That's
and
awesome.
It's a cool book. And they have pictures of his life that they did that I can read to my grandchildren. One of the pictures here, well, this is his truck. Mm-hmm. And this is a picture that's behind me on my desk. It's in the book. When Dad retired at age 55, he went to the local grocery stores, picture behind me, and he picked up day old food, vegetables, bread. He called it his bread run, and gave it to homeless shelters around the city. Mm-hmm. He did that 4 days a week, 5 days a week for 20 years. And he'd take his truck and he'd pick up food, and then he'd deliver it to people that were in need.
And to the listeners, you're showing a picture of the children's book that was made for you with a picture of your dad by the truck.
He's by his truck. Now, he passed away 12 years ago, but that legacy continues. I don't give out food. That isn't my gift, but I try to do other things and we all give back. And
but how did that make you feel watching your father do that? And how did that shape your values and what you wanted to become?
For a long time, it irritated me, because every time we visited, I had to go to a 3-hour bread run. and then I started realizing, am I transferring that same set of values? Are we transferring it to our children? So we have 3 children and 10 grandchildren. And are we transferring the values of charity to them? And so we've created a small little fund that our 14-year-old, 13-year-old granddaughter says, I get to give away a little bit of money to a charity.
And did those same values or that experience with your father somehow influence you to get into teaching and research?
No, my father never read a book. He graduated from the university with the lowest GPA in the history of the university.
And yet you've written so many books.
I've written a lot of books. And so my wife and I laugh. My father taught me to give back and to serve, but in Myers-Briggs, I'm an N and he was an S. I'm intuitive. I love creative ideas and freshness. And he's an S. He drives his truck and delivers food. And that's okay. I mean, I think values aren't the same style, but the values behind that style exist. And I was lucky to have parents who taught me that, and mentors today. I have a mentor today who got me into my field, and I call him, and his name is Bonner Ritchie, and he's in his 80s, and he says, David, I know you're writing books, are you doing talks, are you giving back to the world? I've been asked, when are you going to retire? And the answer is, why would I do that? I've done a lot of books, done a lot of research. I boiled it down to a question. When somebody leaves an interaction with you as a leader, do they feel better or worse about themselves? What a simple question.
And so powerful.
So, Jeff, you've done a lot of these interviews. I'm going to now ask you a question. When you think through the people you've talked to, what advice would you give those listening to this podcast?
It's such a great question. And I think one would certainly be, don't be a know-it-all, be a learn-it-all. And I think, who said, Satya Nadella, I believe, said it. But what I keep hearing over and over is that you need some degree of humility. You need to not act as if you know everything. You need to be able to listen to other people's advice and incorporate not everything, but the good things that make sense, especially within the context of, you know, your strategy and your leadership style. Don't be afraid to incorporate that into your own thinking and your own mental models. So I think that's probably the biggest piece and a common element that I hear from people like you that are just way smarter than I am.
Well, using a political quote in a different way, listening to you has just made me smarter. I love it. Learn it all with a sense of humility and be certain about your commitment to growing. Very nicely done. Thank you.
And Professor, thank you so very much. This has been an incredible hour. I could talk to you for all day, but I know you've got things to do. So thank you very, very much. Thank you so much to our audience around the world for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you have any questions or comments for our guests or want to attend private conversations and events, feel free to visit us at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we hope you'll join us next week.